Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Federal Express and the first major scientific study of alternate fuel performance is underway in Los Angeles. Operation Clean Fleet will be testing five fuels for the next 2 years. Also this time, the world's first computerized plastics recycling center opens, but could run into trouble. Not enough plastic, says industry official Bob Elchick.
Recycling involves two actions. Number one, you have to put the material at the curb to be picked up. Number two, you got to purchase products that use recycled material, because if you don't have both actions, the whole thing falls apart.
Some of the stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. For the next 2 years, overnight Federal Express packages delivered in the Los Angeles area will come to you by alternative fuels. 113 Federal Express vehicles in Los Angeles are taking part in Clean Fleet, an operation that actually began several years ago, says Harold Idell, a senior manager at Federal Express headquarters in Memphis, Tennessee.
The company had started its own internal investigation of alternative fuel vehicles and had some on the road when we were approached by Congressman Bill Alexandra, who is also on the Alternative Fuels Council, and proposed that Federal Express be the host fleet for a demonstration project in the dirtiest clean area in the country, according to the measurements. And he approached us with a number of partners at that point in time, and we saw an opportunity, so we said, okay, we will get involved and we will help you run this test, which will be to demonstrate on an equal basis all the fuels and their potentials. This is not a contest of which fuel is best or anything like that. It's to determine where each one is and how that would affect other fleet operators and users over time.
Results of the project will be used by federal and state agencies planning to implement alternative fuels programs in the future. The project is being conducted in Los Angeles, an area with a dubious distinction, says Bill Kelly, spokesperson for the South Coast Air Quality Management District.
The Los Angeles area has the worst air quality in the nation. The air is unhealthful here about 1 out of 2 days of the year, and we violate the standards for 4 pollutants, and the auto is responsible for more than half of our air pollution problem.
Though much has been done already to clean up the air, says Kelly, Clean Fleet represents the most scientific effort to date.
In 1970, a car emitted about 10 times as much as a car emits today that's sold here in California. But to clean up the air here in Los Angeles, we have to reduce the emissions from cars almost another 90% over the next decade or two. To do that, we're going to have not only cleaner engines, but cleaner fuels, cleaner methods of propelling cars or moving cars. And the Clean Fleet project is aimed at evaluating the leading contenders right now among the fuels or power sources for cars, primarily methanol, reformulated gas, compressed natural gas, liquefied petroleum gas, and electric batteries. So what we're going to be doing is testing vehicles that run on each of those fuels, if you will, side by side under uniform conditions, and collecting data over the next couple of years. And that will give us a much better idea which type of fuel to pursue, and for the motor vehicle manufacturers, you know, what type of vehicles they're going to want to build to meet the new standards that California has set.
The experiment was set up and is being conducted by Battelle, an international research firm based in Columbus, Ohio. Battelle spokesperson Helen Latham explains more about the five types of fuels being used in this test.
Reformulated gasoline, which is very common in California and in other parts of the country. Methanol, which is also highly, heavily used in California already. liquefied petroleum gas, or propane, which is a more common name for it, and compressed natural gas, again, which is becoming popular throughout the country, and electricity.
Now, how did those fuels get selected as the test fuels?
The invitation went out to all distributors and producers of alternative fuels who were interested in participating in the project, and in order to participate, they had to become sort of sponsors, a part of this federal and state and private industry coalition. These five fuels agreed to become part of the coalition.
What is being measured in this experiment? Fuel efficiency and fuel emissions, I imagine. What else?
The operational aspects of it, how it affects the delivery of products, how the fuel and maintenance people, the fuelers, maintenance people, and drivers are affected by it, the problems that show up in maintenance data, whether it affects delivery systems, the cost to upgrade the facilities to handle the alternative fuels, changes to the vehicles. All of those kinds of questions will be answered ultimately.
Harold Idell says the drivers of the vehicles have been especially selected for this project, ensuring that each knows how to fuel the vehicles and how to record the data properly. For the experiment, the vehicles are refueled on Federal Express property, not at a commercial gas station. Using compressed natural gas as an example, Idell describes a typical refueling process.
What happens is we have on-site a high-speed fuel compressor and liquid and cylinders, a cascade of cylinders that the natural gas is stored in. And when the courier comes in, or the fueler, depending on which one is doing it, drives into the fueling island, what he sees is a system that looks very similar to a gasoline vehicle, and the nozzle is slightly different. He does have to connect it differently and turn a handle differently. At that point, the vehicle is fueled at about the same speed as a gasoline truck is. When it's completed, it automatically cut off. There's some computer devices on the island which automatically tracks the amount of fuel that's put in, and he enters how many miles the vehicle is running. We keep data on the trucks at that point through an automated system. So when he disconnects, he hangs the nozzle back up like you would a regular gasoline nozzle, and he's off on his way again, he or she.
At the Air Quality Management District, Bill Kelly says the roots of this project go back to the oil embargoes of the 1970s. Concern to protect ourselves from changes in foreign oil supply, combined with increasing concern to clean up the air, it resulted in a new effort by federal and state agencies to find alternative fuels. California, with the worst air quality in the nation, as a result, developed the most stringent air quality standards in the nation.
Then in 1990, it became apparent that the Congress was going to reauthorize, you know, and amend the Federal Clean Air Act and specify in there some tighter auto emission standards and some demonstration or, you know, limited scale use throughout the country of alternate fueled vehicles. So this, I think, raised the interest of the federal government and the Congress in what we were doing here, to look more closely at that and to see if we could link up. And of course, since the auto companies have to meet these standards, and the energy companies are going to have to provide fuels that meet the clean air standards being set here and also nationally by EPA, you know, there was a lot of mutuality of interest. So basically, we all got together on this one.
In the search for alternate fuels, there has developed something of a cyclical argument. The auto manufacturers have been hesitant to develop vehicles until there is a fuel on which they will run. Energy producers have been slow to develop these fuels without vehicles that will burn them. In a market-driven economy, no one has been willing to yield. Even though the project has only recently begun, Helen Latham at Battelle says a great deal has already been learned.
First of all, one of the aspects of forcing the fleets to comply with these stricter standards sooner than the regular motorist is that will cause the construction and development of the infrastructure needed to support them. And particularly in this project, we've already learned a lot about the modifications, for example, that have to be made to a typical fueling area to accommodate such vehicles, both for the fuel facility and access by the vehicles, and also meeting the building codes and the fire regulations in these communities where they are not accustomed to dealing with this type of fuel. So experiments like this will cause those infrastructures to be developed at least on a demonstration basis and give a lot of background to those who will ultimately build them for the rest of us.
Helen Latham of Battelle Corporation, a research firm in Columbus, Ohio. Harold Idell is Federal Express Senior Manager of Vehicle Engineering and Planning in Memphis, Tennessee. Bill Kelly is spokesman for the South Coast Air Quality Management District. The fleet vehicles will be monitored by Federal Express officials with the results sent back from Los Angeles to Memphis. All other data, including air quality and information about the fueling stations, will be collected by officials at the California Energy Commission and the Air Quality Management District in Los Angeles. Battelle will be collecting all this information from all sources and provide computer analysis of the experiment's progress. The $6.5 million cost of the two-year project is being funded by a coalition of federal agencies such as the Department of Energy, state agencies in California, the auto manufacturers, and the fuel providers. Early results are expected by the end of this year. We'll keep you posted. This is Bruce Robertson. ...50% of the country's electricity comes from burning coal. However, the costs of operating power plants are increasing by 6% a year. But advanced photovoltaic technology generating electricity from sunlight could change the way we estimate the costs and benefits of an energy source. More from Ann Harrison.
Photovoltaic panels, which use semiconductors to convert sunlight into electricity, were once considered too expensive to provide an alternative energy source. But scientists at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden, Colorado, have recently developed ways to make this technology cheaper. Larry Kazmersky is a principal scientist at the lab.
The very first progress on bringing down costs through manufacturing and everything else has been sort of accomplished. And now it's going to be tweaking up the system to take it down from this $5 a watt down to less than $1 a watt over this next 5 years.
Photovoltaic technology may be getting less expensive, but some economists say that if fuel costs, the reliability of fuel supply, and environmental impact were factored into the total cost of an energy source, solar would already come out ahead. Shimon Auerbach, a professor of finance at the University of Massachusetts, says that when these factors are taken into consideration, the future cost of solar energy can be predicted with more certainty than coal, oil, or nuclear power.
The traditional way that utilities have of evaluating technologies involves making a 30-year forecast of fuel prices. And it turns out we really can't predict fuel prices 24 months in advance, let alone 30 years. So unless you adjust those projections and for the riskiness, the probability that fuel price will not be as projected, you're getting estimates of particular technologies that are very, very misleading.
In the kitchen of Cher and Charles Bobeau's home outside of Boulder, Colorado, photovoltaic technology is already being used as a primary source of power. The Bobeaus installed a solar electricity system because it was cheaper than extending utility lines. But Cher Bobeau says there were other reasons why they chose photovoltaics.
So we picked a photovoltaic system because it would also support the environment. I don't really want to be tapped into public system and be vulnerable in whatever the future may bring.
Federal energy planners want to see solar generating 3 to 6% of the nation's electricity by the year 2000. But a home system like the Bobeaus still costs around $12,000. And limited government funding for solar research has hurt U.S. manufacturers of photovoltaic systems. While the U.S. once controlled half of the worldwide photovoltaic market, it now hangs on to only 30%. Critics charge that the development of photovoltaics has lagged because the U.S. government chooses to subsidize other energy sources. Shimon Auerbach adds that until utility companies stop passing the costs of increased fuel prices directly onto consumers, there won't be much incentive to pursue more efficient sources of energy.
If they were held accountable for changing fuel prices so that their earnings fluctuated radically year to year as fuel prices change, they would have considerably more incentive to invest in things like solar energy, which provide electricity at a very fixed, constant cost year to year.
This summer, Congress is trying to pass a National Energy Strategy bill. It includes a proposal that the federal government finance 50% of the cost of renewable energy projects and subsidize interest rates on bank loans for this development. But money hasn't yet been allocated to put these ideas in motion, and the bill has been held up by a filibuster in the Senate. So it remains to be seen whether lawmakers are serious about supporting renewable energy.
N. Harrison, reporting for the High Plains News Service, a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils based in Billings, Montana.
Right now, as they're pulling it off, you'll see an awful lot of material. We've seen shoes, gloves, metal pipe, stovepipe. You'd be surprised what you...
Carol McCourt stands in front of a conveyor belt which is covered with grimy plastic bottles. As he points out, one of the drawbacks to plastic recycling, it's not very clean. But until recently, the only way to sort out contaminants, like shoes and pipes, was by hand. McCourt is president of Automation Industrial Control, a Baltimore company working as a troubleshooter for industry. He's worked on everything from highway construction problems to solid waste, but about 2 years ago, McCourt turned his attention to plastics recycling. He has developed the PolySort system, one of the world's first automated methods of sorting plastic bottles. The containers first have to be separated by resin, or type of plastic, and color, before they can be recycled. To detect the resin, McCourt installed an infrared beam in the system, which identifies the bottle for a computer.
The infrared sends a beam through the plastic, and it's a waveform that you would put up on a monitor, and it's what you get out of it, what they call an interferogram. It's a series of peaks and valleys, if you will. And you look at that particular waveform, and you pick out various points that are redundant to the plastic itself, and you hold that in memory. So PET would have its own waveform, PVC would have an entirely different waveform, HDPE would have an entirely different waveform. We put that in memory, and when the bottle comes down and it goes through the beam, we do a compare function in our 486 microprocessor, and then therefore we can divert it. This is our computer control cabinet. You can actually see when it goes through, you'll see the type 1, type 2, type 3, type 5, whatever the plastic is. We read it, we hold it into memory.
Here, McCourt points to a computer screen which displays split-second images of each bottle as it passes through a small tunnel. A color camera takes a picture of the bottle in the tunnel, identifying the color and shade of the plastic. The computer then stores the color and resin information in its memory and keeps track of each bottle's position on the conveyor belt. When the bottles move outside the tunnel, the computer signals jets of air to blow the plastics into appropriate bins. If a bottle cannot be identified, McCourt says the computer automatically sends it to a discard pile at the end of the conveyor. He says this extra precaution prevents the kind of mistakes made in hand sorting. A job, he says, incidentally, with a 2 to 3 week turnover. He argues there are other benefits to an automated system as well.
We feel that this type of system is going to take not only the labor intensiveness out of handling of the material, but it's also going to have a healthier atmosphere for those people that are trying to sort by hand, because, quite frankly, the employer has to train people all the time because they're the life is of the laborer here is maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and that's where it is all over. But we find that it's going to be more profitable for the employer since he really doesn't need the people there to sort. Our system will run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It doesn't go for lunch or it doesn't go on vacation or anything else. And it doesn't fatigue after a couple of hours. So
McCourt installed his first polysort system at the North American Recycling Systems plant in Fort Edward in upstate New York. He says people at this plant who used to sort plastics by hand now will be given other jobs, such as running the machinery or monitoring the computers. Well, that's the kind of change Bob Elchick likes to see. Elchick is a member of Partnership for Plastics Progress, a group which funds research for better recycling systems like Polysort. Elchick also works for the Occidental Chemical Corporation, one of the many plastics companies which make up the partnership group. He says his company likes the Polysort method because it sorts bottles 3 times faster than human workers. It also makes fewer mistakes, which means a purer, more valuable end product. According to Elchick, the main problem now is the public. He says we are not recycling enough plastic bottles.
We have a shortage of recycled PVC bottles. As I've said before, we've closed the loop. You know, we're selling to bottle blowers at what we call EcoVinyl, which is a 25% clear PVC, recycled PVC bottle compound. We're limited this year to only being able to sell 5 million pounds because we can only get on a little over 1 million pounds from collection. As collection increases for PVC, we'll be able to sell more.
According to the Partnership for Plastics Progress, only 11% of all plastic bottles and containers is being recycled. Their goal is to reach 25% by 1995. But while we are starting to separate the recyclables in our trash, Elchick says the business community is now running into a problem at the other end of the process.
The consumer has not voted for recycling of plastics in particular with their purchases. You know, I like to tell people when I give talks to small groups or even large groups that recycling involves 2 actions. Number one, you have to put the material at the curb to be picked up. Number two, you got to purchase products that use recycled material, because if you don't have both actions, the whole thing falls apart. Prime example, Procter & Gamble about 2 years ago put Spick and Span in a 100% recycled bottle. It was 100% recycled PET plastic. Now, if the public really wanted recycling, that should have become the most popular detergent on the supermarket shelf. All its competition would have been forced to switch to a similar type of bottle. Didn't happen. So the public has really got to get involved in the other half of the recycling question, which is buying products with recycled content.
Bob Elchick represents the Occidental Chemical Corporation in the Partnership for Plastics Progress. Carol McCourt is president of Automation Industrial Control of Baltimore, Maryland. While we may be lagging behind in our recycling efforts, McCourt says recycling companies are beginning to express interest in this polysort system, with the computer identification of bottles as the attention getter. One other note, if a company needs to recycle a new, unrecognizable type of plastic, McCourt simply scans it with the infrared beam and enters the new code into the computer. In the future, the computer may be asked to pick out other plastic items, like margarine tubs and other food containers. But for now, while the automated sorting does move 3 times as fast, McCourt emphasizes it is up to us to provide the plastic to make the system work. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on The Environment Show this week. We hope you enjoyed the program. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 139. That's 1-800-767-1929. The Environment Show, program number 139. Our story on the computer plastics recycling was written and produced by Karen Kelly. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont.